Programming is supported by Topline Construction Firm, your local women-owned roofing contractor based out of Shoreview, Minnesota. Roof replacement, both retail and insurance work. More information at toplineconstructionfirm.com.
You're listening to a recording of a live radio show on NPR News. If you want to listen to us in real time, you can stream our show live weekdays at 9 a.m. Central. Thanks for listening and enjoy the show.
I'm Carrie Miller, and this is NPR News, but I still have questions about what I was talking with Adolphus about, and so maybe we can work that into this discussion that we're having. As our Women of Faith series continues, mindfulness in the midst of so much turmoil. Now, we had this show booked for some time. Little did we know how necessary the conversation with Sharon Salzberg would be on a day like this. We live, as noted, in noisy and distressing times. So in this newest Women of Faith conversation, we're going to talk about how Buddhist practices can quell or manage our anxiety. As Sharon Salzberg joins us, I think we'd both like to hear from you. Have meditation or other mindfulness practices been helpful for your anxiety? Is anxiety something that your faith community, whatever denomination you belong to, can help with? How are you feeling at this moment? Have you turned to meditation and mindfulness practices? You can talk to us about it this morning, 651-227-6000, 800-242-2828, and on Twitter at CarrieMPR. Sharon Salzberg is the co-founder of the Insight Meditation Society and the co-founder of the Barr Center for Buddhist Studies. She's the author of many books, including Real Love, The Art of Mindfulness Connection, and she joins us today from New York City. Sharon, welcome. It's good to have you on the show.
Thank you so much.
I can't think of a better moment and a more needed moment, I guess, to have a conversation with you about mindfulness. So tell me how in the midst of this tumultuous political and racialized conversation we're having, that you seek out insight and that you try to separate the noise from the things that you really need to hear and know. How do you do it?
Well, I mean, we kind of have to do it. I think, first of all, I think anxiety has been on the rise for a while now. When I look at the forms people fill out when they come to the center that I co-founded, the Insight Meditation Society, and people briefly list, say, what medication they're on, now I see, like, medication for anxiety, for anxiety, for anxiety, for anxiety. It used to be a lot more depression. So I wonder if this comes in waves in terms of manifestation of dis-ease. There also, I hear studies about an epidemic of loneliness sweeping the country and not just this country. So there's a lot to look at here. I think mindfulness is key, first of all, to know what we're feeling as we're beginning to feel it before things escalate, to have a handle on creating some space. It's not to deny what we're feeling or say it's meaningless. It might be very meaningful in some ways, but we don't necessarily want to be guided or driven by everything that comes up in our minds. And so to have some space, to be able to look at what's happening and to say, do I want to follow this out? Do I want to take this to heart? Or maybe this one I just let go of.
You know, you said to know what we're feeling before it kind of spins out of control. Tell me specifically how to do that, because I think we're immersed in a pool here that urges us to go from 0 to 65 in an instant. It's hard to pull back the reins and say, "Let me get in touch here for a minute on where this would be headed if I let it, you know, spin forward like that." So how do you do that?
Well, it's actually, mindfulness is like a training. You know, it's you could say it's a natural capacity, but it's actually a training so that we have an ability to be present much more quickly, and we're so much more in touch, and we have a different relationship to what's going on. You know, it's not like an endless training. You don't have to prepare forever. You don't have to practice studiously for 12 hours a day. It's actually just minutes a day, but it is minutes. You know, it's really just training and practicing. It used to be that my favorite definition of mindfulness came from an article in the New York Times. It was many years ago. It was about a very early program on bringing mindfulness into schools, and it was about a fourth grade classroom in Oakland, California. So they asked one of the kids, so he's in fourth grade, let's say 9 or 10 years old. They said to him, "What's mindfulness?" And he said, "Mindfulness means not hitting someone in the mouth." That's what mindfulness means. And I thought, great definition. Because what does it imply? It implies, you know, you're feeling angry when you're starting to feel angry. Not after you've sent off that email. Not after you've hit someone in the mouth. And it also implies a certain balanced relationship to the anger. And this is another really crucial element of mindfulness. It's, you know, if you hate what you're feeling and you're afraid of it and you're ashamed of it and you're trying to repress it and you get all uptight, you're just going to explode. It's not going to work. But at the same time, if you fall into every passing emotion, if you get overwhelmed all of the time, then you're going to probably hit a lot of people in the mouth. So we want a relationship to that anger where we're fully connected, but there's also some space, and that's where the choice comes in.
I think that makes so much sense. Balanced relationship, right, to the anxiety and to the mm-hmm. anger. So is there such a thing as mindful outrage? Because outrage sounds excessive, but I know some people will, many of us will argue that there are times when you need that to drive you to action. Mm-hmm. So can you be mindfully outraged for all the right reasons sometimes? Not live that way, but sometimes?
Right, right. Well, that's a crucial distinction, I think. I think outrage is what wakes many of us up. You know, we're kind of going along, we're living our lives, and something happens to us or we witness something, and this immense kind of outrage arises. And we need that energy. That's what we really need, is the energy of it. And that's very different than being in a sort of chronically outraged condition, which yeah. also many people are these days. There's a wonderful quote. I'm writing a book right now on mindfulness, loving kindness, and social change. And so I was trying to source this quote, which is very familiar to most people, which is something like, if you get overwhelmed with anger, then it's like drinking poison, hoping that the other guy's going to die. And so first I thought, I think Nelson Mandela said that. And so I looked it up and it was like, I've seen Nelson Mandela, Oprah Winfrey, Alcoholics Anonymous, you know, I don't know who said it. But there's a lot of wisdom there, you know. So when we are chronically outraged or angry, when we're defined by that, when our choices are really governed by that over and over again, it is like poisonous to us. It's so toxic. And energy to our bodies, to our minds, to our spirits, to our relationships, that it's mostly self-destructive at that point, and that's what we don't want.
Take a call here from Randy in St. Paul. Hi, Randy. Good to have you in on the conversation. What are you thinking about?
Well, I'm thinking how much I love you for bringing this conversation up.
I'm glad.
We all have this curiosity, and this is a very troubling time. I've had a meditation practice for about 50 years now, and I have to say that one of the hardest things is skillful means in speech. And it's put on the top of the list. And how do you do that when you're in the face of ignorance and someone who's unwilling to listen to you? And there's a 13th century Zen master that gave me some wisdom when I was 60 years old. I can't believe I didn't get it sooner. He said that when you're in the face of ignorance, it's best to just stand there and not try to change or educate ignorance. Mm-hmm. You'll only make them angry. Mm-hmm. He says, let them know that you don't agree, stand tall, and know that one day you will have a story to tell them that illustrates your wisdom, and they won't know you're talking about them.
Oh. It's kind and patient and, I would think, pretty difficult. Have you been able to practice it, Randy?
It is so hard, and right. It's truly the essence of wholesome speech, and that where you recognize that who you perceive as your enemy is you, and as soon as you lose love and compassion for that person who wants to hit you in the mouth, you've lost the battle, and we can yell at each other and try to change each other, and it very seldom does anything until we can kind of touch our hearts and find out where we have some common ground.
Sharon, what do you think?
I think that's beautiful, and thank you. And I agree with all of it. It's a really difficult realm, and every time I'm talking about, say, compassion for all beings, for all of life, somebody will write to me and say, well, why should I have compassion for this person who doesn't think I should exist, you know, because of my gender orientation or whatever? You know, they actually would like to annihilate me. And that's, you know, that's a real issue in a lot of ways. What we don't want is to sort of kind of become the enemy, right? And so even with some mild degree of compassion for yourself, again, you don't necessarily want to be drinking that poison. And then we explore, what does it mean to stand there, you know, stand there upright, stand there with dignity, and not have that toxicity enter you? And to, at the most, express your experience, not to try to educate, as you say, and not to lecture, certainly. I come back sometimes in those difficult conversations to what I found to be a really sweet little story about the Buddha, where they said he was walking on some farmer's land someday, and maybe he was walking without permission. He was doing something like that, and the farmer got really angry and came over and started yelling at him and screaming and reviling him and abusing him. And the Buddha said something to him like, what happens, O farmer, when you nicely prepare a gift for somebody and you hold it out in your hand and they refuse to take it out of your hand? And the farmer said, well, then I guess it remains with me. And the Buddha said, just so, O farmer, I'm refusing your gift of screaming and yelling and cursing and reviling. It's going to remain with you. So I don't necessarily at all say that in conversation with somebody, but I actually bring that image up in my mind. You know, this is yours. This is your energy. I'm not taking it on. There's a boundary here. And from that place of feeling protected by that boundary, I actually can look in a different way at this person and think about them in a different way. Like, that's an awfully kind of petty, mean-spirited energy to be devoting your life to. You know, like, this is what you've chosen as a path to happiness, and there is a kind of compassion there.
Sharon Salzberg is with us if you've just tuned in. She's part of our Women of Faith series through the spring and the summer, and she's the co-founder of the Insight Meditation Society, co-founder of the Barr Center for Buddhist Studies. She's the author of a number of books, including Real Love, The Art of Mindfulness Connection. And as it happened, she joins us on this day with, again, that we're embroiled in a really corrosive debate about nationalism and race and what it means to be an American. And so we've begun the conversation talking about how you stand in compassion as outrage swirls around us, how you make your voice heard, but you don't respond with the kind of corrosive outrage that you see swirling around us, and why that is so difficult to do. And if you've practiced meditation or mindfulness practices, I'd love to hear your reflections on that. Has it been helpful to you? Is it helpful for the anxiety that you feel perhaps in your personal life, perhaps, you know, as a citizen of your community with a lot of the turmoil that's going on? I'd like to hear about that as well. 651-227-6000, 800-242-2828, on Twitter, at CarrieNPR. And Sharon, here's Jaleka, who says, longtime listener, love your show, but the last thing we need to think about is mindfulness in response to the overt racism coming from the White House and the GOP this week. I mean, this is, Sharon, this is what, and I'm telling you, I've had probably this version, different versions of a similar conversation for months now. How do you stand, as I said, firm in compassion and understanding and be influential about that in the midst of this kind of corrosive behavior from President Trump and others?
Oh, it depends on what you mean by mindfulness as well. You know, if you mean some kind of trance-like, soporific state where you're doing just fine, you know, and you don't care about anybody else, then I agree. Like, who needs that? You know, we have enough of that anyway. And it wouldn't be a training well worth developing at all. But, of course, I mean something very different by mindfulness. And the question actually reminds me a little bit of a couple of times now online. I've helped organize a minute of loving kindness for the kids at the border, the kids in cages, the kids separated from their families. And I've gotten some feedback like that, like, you're as bad as the people who just send thoughts and prayers, you know, like, why aren't you doing something? And my response, which is very heartfelt, you know, and really comes from my experience, is this is hard for me to look at. This is hard for me to hang in there with. And to be able to be there in this energy is how I stay connected, instead of saying, I can't bear this. You know, this is too much for me. And it's also very important for me, sincerely, to be able to connect to something bigger, even as I'm looking directly at it and thinking what I can do. You know, I don't only do the minute of loving kindness or compassion, but it helps me take action in a way that is more sustaining, you know, that isn't leading to such overwhelm and burnout and disgust and, you know, just this kind of energy that's just going to bring me down and make me just want to look the other way.
You know what I also hear in some of those responses, and I know you also get supportive responses, but what I hear in the mean responses is a kind of helplessness and shame. I don't know what to do with this. I don't know what to do about this. I wish I could do more. I mean, I think some of this fury, embedded in this fury that comes at people who are saying, don't respond in kind, you know, is personifying, I think, the frustration and the shame and the helplessness that we feel. And a lot of us feel that way.
I mean, I think that's very astute. I mean, even going back to Buddhist psychology, you know, they talk about anger being that which we pick up when we feel weak because we think it's going to make us strong. And in some ways, it does make us strong. You know, it's an energy that allows us to say no, to draw boundaries, to insist that people look at what's uncomfortable. You know, sometimes it's the angriest person in the room that's pointing out the situation everyone else is studiously avoiding. Like, let's look the other way. You know, so there's a lot of power in that. There's a lot of energy in that. But it's also like a burning. It's like into a forest fire, which can burn up its own support. So, you know, it will help deal with that feeling of helplessness, which is one of the most painful, debilitating feelings. But at what cost? So then the question is, can we go right back, and here's the role for mindfulness, to that feeling of helplessness, be able to hang out there with it, which is honest. You know, this is what's really underlying a lot of our reactions, and build from there a kind of strength that, you know, has some elements of that outrage, but not necessarily the kind of burning and the corrosiveness.
You know, it's interesting. So I hear you saying, don't turn away from that experience of helplessness, which is, I think that's very difficult to do. I'm not saying, I think it's hard to embrace it and examine it. I mean, it's kind of what you said about anxiety, catch it before it becomes a full-blown anxious experience. You're also saying, don't let the helplessness be kind of the end-all be-all, right? There's a way to turn back and look into it. I think that's hard
that's
to
right.
do. Wow.
It's very hard to say. I mean, we're talking about the hardest stuff, you know. It's like usually people start with a little awareness of the breath, you know, or something kind of prosaic. And not that this, you know, realm is not included. It's definitely included. But that's another reason why if you are interested, it becomes a practice. It becomes a kind of training because it's like building blocks, you know. Sometimes we're just with very ordinary kind of experience. And it's a little boring, but we're learning how to hang in there anyway and finding nuance and subtlety and ordinary experience. And sometimes it's exhilarating, whatever we're going through. And we feel lifted up and we feel just this tremendous joy. And that is something, sadly enough, we're often distracting ourselves from as well. It's not that easy for a lot of people to kind of let in the joy and to experience it really much more fully. And then, of course, there are these very, very painful things that we can have the strength to deal with. And and a different understanding of, and we're going through all of it.
Call here from Tom in Bloomington. Hi, Tom. Appreciate you waiting.
Hi. Would yeah, I'm sorry. I'm on my speakerphone, so apologize for that.
Well, we can hear
but
you.
I think every situation we have a we know that there's people out there who are basically human garbage trucks, and they're trying to dump on us. And we have a choice. We can say, okay, let me just dump on me and walk away. We have a second choice of, gee, where did that come from? What is your experience? And third choice would be to say something like, wow, all of those words came out so swimmingly. I feel sorry for you because someone must be feeding you that kind of garbage.
What do you think of that analogy, Sharon?
I like it because every time I use something like the Buddha and the farmer, I think, oh, what's the contemporary version of that? So I've been listening and think, oh, I like that.
To Jennifer in Minneapolis. Hi, Jennifer. Thank you so much for waiting.
Hi. Thank you. My question is, so it's not necessarily political, though it does parallel the same feelings, the helplessness and the anger. I struggle with, I can meditate, I can do my singing bowl, I can do all these things, but the moment where something arises, it's like the fight or flight just takes over and everything just goes out the window. Everything I've practiced, and no matter how hard I try, my heart is pounding, you know, everything is just going. And I'm just wanting to know if there's a way to put a pause in to that moment, because it's very, very difficult for me. And especially when people aren't following the rules, you know, I'm a big rule follower. And so it does mimic, even though I'm not talking about political stuff, I'm talking about personal stuff. It's it mimics the exact feelings of what's going on in our political climate for the past couple of years.
Sharon?
Yeah, I mean, it's definitely way, in a way, that's the whole point, you know, is being able to bring these things into life, into our life as we experience it. And you're certainly not alone in having kind of a fight or flight or freeze, which is another alternative. I was so happy when they added that because I thought, oh, that's mine, you know.
The freezing is yours?
The freezing, you know, in the face of stress. So, you know, I mean, that is in a way that's the way we're wired, although there's also possibilities that they've done research on things like tend and befriend. You know, in the face of stress, we want to help take care of someone or join together to meet some kind of adverse situation. But this is really what we practice for, is for that gap. And the first thing I would say is it's not bad that, you know, you have that kind of biological automatic reaction. That's just the nature of things. And when you experience that in meditation, that's not something to avoid because that's how we learn to create space around it. A lot of people think of meditation, although I don't know if that's been your experience, as a time to kind of block thoughts or have this blank slate, you know, not have a lot come up. And really, that's not the point. You know, our work is to try to develop a different relationship to everything. So maybe we have this turbulent energy moving through our bodies, but we have a greater sense of space around it so that we're not taking it so to heart. We're not just identifying with it so much. And that's a very different experience of it. It's things like that we're really working on. And sometimes what we do is informal meditation. We actually bring to mind those kinds of scenarios that will elicit a certain, especially a visceral reaction. And that's the training, because that becomes our feedback system. So I have a friend, for example, who describes herself as someone who could never say no. And of course, she was always burnt out. And so when she would sit in meditation, she would purposely bring up those scenarios in her mind and feel what happened in her body. And that sense of almost like panic coming up and taking over was then her feedback system. So when she was at work, she was in an actual conversation, and she was asked that very kind of question, and she would feel that panic come up. She knew that was the signal to say to somebody, I'll have to get back to you later. It's like she couldn't quite bring herself to say no, but later she could say no. And so many of these things happen in our bodies before we see them cognitively, or, you know, the thought process, like, oh, God, they're asking me this. You know, and so that's why we really pay attention to sensations. We pay attention to the way emotions manifest as sensations, and And that's a part of practice.
Nate in Mankato called to say meditation is a religious form. It's a mind form of dealing with stress. People can learn to take a deep breath, and it can help them with the stress they're dealing with. It helps to let go of all the negativity. We have limited time on Earth, and we try to breathe and relax. I was reading what you were writing on Krista Tippett's On Being site, Sharon, mm-hmm. about breathing, and I thought this was notable. You write, when the brain is spinning out one horrifying outcome after another, it doesn't have enough space to clearly perceive the world around us as it is in mm-hmm. this moment. And I thought, as in, if I calmed and breathed and observed, I would see that the scenarios that are looping through my head aren't happening as I feared, right? But I do have to give my mind space to understand that.
Mm-hmm.
Is that it?
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, meditation can be seen as a religious process. It doesn't have to be at all. It's really a kind of mental training. It's training attention to be different, to be more full, more present, more spacious, and therefore more insightful, more understanding. So it's a lot of what you described. Like, something I've been noticing in my own mind recently, and I have been saying to myself, is, why are you rehearsing that? You know, like, I have friends who describe themselves as recovering catastrophizers, you know, and I never thought of myself that way. And I'm actually seeing some patterns where, oh, that's likely going to happen, or what if, you know, I lose my lease. And,
so
you
the
know,
so the rehearsing is, I'm watching myself go through this, even though it isn't really happening. And here's what
That's
it would
right.
feel like, and here's what I would do. Yeah.
You know, and I find, wow, look at what you're doing. and so the anchor is the breath, and that's so we can kind of recalibrate. You know, maybe we've gotten lost in something or way reactive to something. We can come back to the breath and just kind of chill, you know. And then we go looking at a wider expanse of our experience again.
Call here from Tegan in Cottage Grove. Hi, Tegan.
Hi.
Glad you waited. What do you want to say? What do you want to add here?
Yeah, so I'm actually a full-time student during the school year. And, you know, I lay my head down to sleep at the end of a long day. And, you know, like, that's the time you should be the most calm. But that's always the time when my anxiety triggers and I start going over my day and I did this wrong, or I have this deadline coming up, or I have this deadline coming up, you know?
Yeah.
And I've discovered that that's, like, the perfect time for me to meditate. And I just, like, connect to myself and let the rest of the day go so I can become myself again, not the rest of the past day.
So, do you, Tegan, use music or just a quiet room, a dark room? What are your surroundings like when you're doing this?
Yeah, so I'm usually, like, in my dorm room with the lights off, and I play a guided meditation that goes through, like, a body scan. And that helps me a lot, just kind of connect to my body.
That's the relaxing all the way up your body, right? The steps to go from toes right up to the top of your head?
Yep.
Huh. Sharon, are those helpful for you?
Yeah, I mean, that actually was the first technique I ever learned, except
really?
We started with the top of the head and moved down.
Uh-huh.
So these days people tend to start at the toes, but there are lots of techniques, you know. Some of them are very much body-oriented. Some of them, you know, as you first started speaking, I was thinking, oh, well, if you have the habit, as most of us do, of going over the day and only thinking about the mistakes you've made and the problems you've had, then even just a simple gratitude reflection will be a kind of balancing. You know, are there three things I have to be grateful for from today? And it just kind of changes the energy that we're going through. And some people use loving-kindness meditation, where we're resting our attention on the silent repetition of certain phrases, like, may you be happy, may you be peaceful. And I have a friend who had terrible insomnia, and she would start off lying in bed, you know, not trying to get up and meditate formally, but just lying in bed, she would offer loving kindness to all beings who are awake. So that was herself, but it was also like people going to work at the other end of the world, and water buffalo in India, and whatever. And then after a while, offering loving kindness to all beings who are asleep, which was not herself, but presumably her neighbors. And in the end, she had like the entire world covered and all kinds of life forms. And she had a really good time and she fell asleep.
Wow. Yeah. You know, as I was reading about your background and your practices, I was thinking about a conversation that I had earlier this spring with Emily and Amelia Nagoski. They wrote this book called Burnout, and they write about the science of chronic stress and how physical activity is so essential to letting stress complete its circuit. And how if you interrupt that circuit without doing some kind of, as you're saying, your breathing or the physical activity, that circuit never completes. Listen to how they describe the science of this.
Stress is a cycle, like all of our biological cycles. It has a beginning, a middle, and an end. And if we can get to the end of the stress response cycle, if we can let our body move from a stress state to a relaxed state, then all our body systems return to normal. But if we stay stuck in the middle of that cycle, we stay in a state where our immune system and digestive system and reproductive systems are all suppressed. And that gradually leads to the degrading of those systems, chronic illness, and in the case of Amelia and lots of other women, actual hospitalization.
Emily Nagoski there from her book, Burnout. Sharon, does that, where does physical activity fit into this for you, this idea of mindfulness and meditation and addressing chronic stress?
I think it's fantastic. I mean, literally, there is a walking meditation or a moving meditation, which becomes part of our day, you know, partly because it's something we do just mechanically, like lost in a daydream or a plan, and we can kind of make it come alive with our awareness. And there's also just the question of intention. You know, like I've worked a fair amount with people who are caregivers, either personally in their families or professionally, domestic violence shelter workers or international humanitarian aid workers. And one of the things I learned amongst many I learned from them say with the international humanitarian aid workers, they would say when they would start to get burnt out, one of the first things that would go were like safety measures. You know, people were no longer taking care of themselves and protecting themselves. And of course, things just got worse and worse and worse. And so, you know, there needs to be a certain measure both of energy but also intentionality and recognizing, oh, I count too. I need to make sure this happens. I need to get up and not just sit at this desk forever. You know, I need to get up and move. I need to add this to my day. And then it becomes something, you know, that is hugely helpful. But it's like the hurdle is to get up from your desk. Once you're up and moving, then, you know, it's fine. It's great.
To Larry in Minneapolis. Hi, Larry. Sounds like you're here to talk about physical activity, running as a form of meditation. Good.
Yeah, I'm a competitive middle distance runner, but I don't think you have to be competitive to think about it this way. I find running really relaxing, and you might think because it's athletic and you're sweating, it's all about the intensity. But it's the only thing I really do by myself, and I think everybody needs some space by themselves. And so even though I'm running hard and fast, I'm pondering what I've been doing over the day and maybe things that are bugging me. And if things are bugging me, maybe I run faster. But but it allows me to process things. And so I try to use that. I don't even know if I try, but I think I just automatically use that as kind of time and space to reflect on things. And I find when I get done, I'm tired from running, but I'm also kind of cleansed from the experience.
And Larry, I mean, time kind of passes and you're not really focused on, I'm at mile four and this is hard. I mean, it allows you to kind of go into a mental space where you're not just tracking, as you've said, the athletic intensity of this, it sounds like.
Well, you can do both. I mean, I'll know where mile four is, and I can look at my watch, and I can do the math real fast and figure I'm at this kind of clip. But then I can just kind of let go of that and for another mile or two just spend my time pondering. And maybe I just kind of look at the scenery, but a lot of times it ends up being kind of reflective, and I'm very peaceful when I get done.
Good. Thank you very much for the call. I want to hear from John in St. Paul as well. John, sounds like you have a question for Sharon.
Yes, I do. I'm just wondering what your thoughts are in terms of what we can control in our lives versus what we cannot control. I found that once I've been able to figure that out and get those lines in my life, then it's much easier, much more relaxing for me to move on with my life.
So what we can control and can't control, Sharon, how to wrangle with that, I guess?
Yeah, and I also try to make a distinction between what I can influence or affect compared to control. I think we can influence or affect a great deal, but not have control. We don't have control. For example, this was one of my early and repeated learnings in meditation practice. We don't have control in terms of what will come up in our minds. You can say with the best will in the world, you know, I've grieved enough, it's done, or I'll never get frightened again, or I'll never fall asleep meditating again. And when conditions come together for something to arise, it will arise. How we relate to it, whether we get overwhelmed by it, whether we have more space with it, more presence with it, that is something that we really work strongly with. I don't know if I'd even use the word control there, but that is something we can really train so that, you know, for all the times people feel humiliated, for example, because they got jealous or they got frightened and are so down on themselves, we actually cannot stop it. But how are we with it becomes the question. So, of course, this is the strong orientation of meditation, is that we can't control the external conditions we face. Our boss gets sick. Something really radical happens because of that. Or, you know, there's the subway is not working today. And so I'm incredibly late or whatever it is. There's so much in just the ordinary experience of life we have no control over, but and we will never have control over. But our work is really to, you know, really mold the things that give us a different kind of strength as different tools so that we have an ability to really strongly influence how we are with things.
Boy, I have to tell you, Sharon, I really aspire to that, and you've phrased it in a way that I've never thought of. You know, I think of myself as a control freak, and where does stress come from when I feel like I can't change the outcome or I can't impose my will enough to make it go the way I want it to? But what you've just said is, so then turn it back in on yourself. How are you with what's happening? Do I have that? Is that right?
Yes, it's great. Yeah, because when have we ever been able to be in total control?
Right. From Twitter, Jonathan says, I've never heard mindfulness as empowering before. It's a shift, at least in my understanding, and understanding what's happening to center ourselves and then go at the problem, truly understanding it. Thank you for your guest today. To Mary in Osceola, Wisconsin. Hi, Mary.
Hi. I have been listening to your show as I've been driving, and I just wanted to put a shout-out for something, a program that I got to hear at the Mayo Clinic. It's was developed by a man called Amit Sood.
Oh, he's been on the show, Gratitude and Happiness, right? Yeah, but it's been a while. Yeah.
And I've got a couple of his books, and I've lucked out because I got to hear him talk a couple of times. But I just want to mention that he was an intern in Bhopal, India, when they had that terrible, terrible chemical spill. And thousands of people died. And he talks in his book and also in his program about the steps that we need to take, the stresses of life, and things we can do to cultivate gratitude, compassion, acceptance, meaning, forgiveness, and relationships. And he has a website, a TED Talk website. It's called Amit Sood. It's about happiness.
Yeah. You know what I'll do, Mary? We're a little tight on time here.
Okay.
I'll find the link to that and I'll tweet it out. But I really appreciate the recommendation. Sharon, who do you read for, I don't know, comfort, meditation at a time, on a day when you're feeling particularly anxious? Who do you turn to?
I go back to some of the earliest books that I read, like Suzuki Roshi's Zen Mind, Beginner's Mind. I find that as I get older and as I, you know, have more years of meditating, the thing that really attracts me is something simple. Or I read poetry.
I wondered about that. Who do you read?
Naomi Shihab Nye would be an example of somebody that I read, who has written some of my favorite poems. And you know, it's very important for me to have that kind of simple, direct teaching, which I used to kind of spurn. I used to think, well, this isn't like ornate enough or elaborate enough. Now I think, oh, how fantastic.
So when you these are the books and these are the teachings that you started out with. And mm-hmm. that, and for a while there, you thought, I've moved beyond that.
That's right.
This needs to be more complicated to be me.
That's right.
Why have you come back around, do you think?
I think maturity and greater understanding.
Do you ever feel like you are, for as many, I mean, and you've got best-selling books and you run these mm-hmm. centers, but do you ever feel like I'm just this small voice in a wilderness of tumultuousness and turmoil. This is not really how I was going to end the show, but you know what I'm asking. Like,
I do.
You have a powerful, important things to say here, and yet when this hour is over, we'll go back to the, you know, to the drama and the outrage. I get what I'm really asking you is how to hang on to this. That's what I want to know.
Well, I hang on to it, you know, through my own personal practice. But I have learned so many times, and perhaps you have as well, that influence or impact is also a big mystery.
Yeah.
I would bet anything there are people who've heard your show and have had, you know, tremendous life-changing experiences and don't tell you, you know, that, you know, it doesn't necessarily come back as direct feedback, except someday, maybe.
Yeah.
You run into them and they say, oh, you know what? I heard that show and I made these other choices. And I've just found that so many times, you know, that even when I've ended programs that have been really hard with, you know, survivors of 9/11 or things where, you know, I've come out and I thought, I don't know if I did anything, you know, of value to anybody. And sometimes years later, in that particular program, actually, it happened years later. Somebody came up to me at something else I was teaching and she said, you know, I first met you that day. You have no idea what you did that day. And it was true. I had no idea whatsoever.
And you went home that day thinking, I have opened one mind and that's not nothing.
Yeah. That's right? Not nothing.
Sharon, thank you. Thank you so much. I really enjoyed the conversation. Good to have you here.
Thank you so much.
Among Sharon Salzberg's books, Real Love, The Art of Mindfulness Connection.
Just heard a recording of a live radio show on NPR News. To add your voice to discussion, you can call in at 800-242-2828 or tweet us at @CarrieNPR. And if you miss us live, you'll find all our shows by subscribing to this podcast. You can send us your questions or comments by emailing talk@npr.org.